The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, guess what time it is? It's time for the greatest radio show you've heard all week. Of course, welcome to the True Wealth Radio Show on this greatest Tuesday you've had all week. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and in studio with me today is...
Justin Bruggeman.
But also because we have three microphones, but only two cameras, who else is in the studio?
Emma Arndt.
Yay, Emma's here. We love Emma. She's super fun. We got to get more cameras going in here, and then we can really throw off our streaming software and see if we can just melt the whole thing down.
Skip four or five.
Yeah, we're live streaming on YouTube, for those of you that don't know, so you're welcome to catch us there if you want to see faces made for radio. Anyway, today is, April almost? We're getting close to tax time.
31st really are. Today. Last day of the month.
It's funny. And sometimes, on rare occasion, we have to run a rerun of the show, just like the way it works out. And I probably shouldn't throw dates all over this one. But honestly, even if you were hearing this again someday, this is not a show about deadlines, but it is still a show that today we're going to talk about the thing that's no fun to talk about. I don't really like talking about this subject either, but it is inescapable. Right, there's just no way around this. So we are going to talk about death. No, I'm kidding. The other thing that never goes. We're going to talk about taxes. We're not going to talk about death. I shouldn't even made that as a joke. I'm going to get destroyed for that at some
point.
Probably. Maybe.
That's not funny, Dave. Jeez. We're going to talk about taxes, and the goal here is this is not a tax wonk show. It's not what we do. But there are so many misunderstandings about taxes that I would love to just sort of clear up by getting a better understanding for all of our listeners.
Okay.
Maybe you know a bunch of this stuff, in which case, great. Maybe you're going to catch a few tips. But the thing is, taxes are foundational to financial planning. And taxes are also really critical that you manage them well, because they can undo a lot of good work in your investments, right?
Right.
You spend a lot of effort trying to make your money work for you, and then you do something that's tax negligent and you undo all of that work. So it needs to be coordinated with your efforts. So that's why we really need to talk about this stuff, because you just can't avoid it. So I'm going to start with this idea of So Justin, I mean, you just like me, you've sat with a lot of people.
Right.
Off the top of your head, is there anything that you think is a consistent or frequent thing that you hear where people just don't really, it's like they just don't have the information about part of the tax code, like something where you're just like, yeah, I see this all the time?
Well, the big one that we see, I guess, most commonly would just be that you can still make contributions to help defer taxes to later. Because, the biggest complaint we have is people don't like to pay taxes.
Yeah, that's the biggest complaint. And so when you say you still make contributions, all right, you're talking about things like retirement plan contributions. All right, sometimes I do this, right? But this, you can tell, we're not scripted on this. What's the point of contributions? Like, what's actually happening, like, in your frame up for our listeners? Just, like, take them to square one.
Well, depending on tax-deferred growth, I guess, would be, whether it be tax-free growth in a Roth or just tax-deferred pre-tax growth in a IRA or 401k, is to not pay the taxes now and pay them later, or them now and not pay them later.
Well, and it's literally, hey, I'm going to owe some taxes, but if I make contributions to a retirement plan, I will owe less tax because I'm able to take a deduction, which reduces the amount of income that I show the IRS on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're talking about. If you ever heard like, oh, business does write-offs or whatever, it's kind of like a personal write-off in many cases, is you might be able to put money in a retirement plan, and instead of paying the taxes now, you defer those taxes into the future. Now, the taxes get paid in the future.
Yeah.
So, but why might it be a good idea to defer taxes into the future instead of pay them now?
Maybe lower income in retirement.
Yeah, you might be in a different tax bracket, meaning your taxes might be cheaper in the future.
Yeah.
So that's part of, that's one of the biggest things we do plan-wise. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about how do we do planning for somebody, like if you have a client that comes in, Justin, let me set up a fictional example, and we're just going to test Justin in real time here.
Okay.
So you have a couple that shows up. They have a couple of retirement, they have IRAs. So his and hers, they each have about $300,000 in IRAs. She's got a 401k with another $150,000 in it from her current job. He's got a small pension from back in the day. It's going to pay him like $500 a month. And they also have a rental property that's fully paid for. Let's say it's worth $300,000. And then they've also got an investment account with about $80,000. It's all in an S&P 500 mutual fund, and they have basis of about $30,000 in it, but it's worth $80,000. Now, I just threw a lot of details at Justin really fast. What can you tell our listeners jumps out at you immediately as something that you would need to plan around?
Well, the big, I guess, thing is, do they still have an income? Are they still working?
Let's say that, yes, they are working, but they plan to retire in the next year.
Okay. Well, I guess there would be, what future income sources are we expecting? I mean, there's...
These are good,
a
by
lot
the
of
way.
Different
Why would you questions. Ask me that question? Why, like, when you ask for future income, what are you kind of searching for?
Well, how much additional pension? Like, I know you said the pension income, but when are they kicking on Social Security?
Okay,
that would make a difference. How much of their distributions are wanting or needing to take in retirement for their lifestyle? I guess it would be what do you need in retirement? Would be the first question.
So, because this is a tax show, here's one of the things I would mention. It is the first thing Justin is doing is he's saying, tell me the income sources, because that's going to help him figure out how much tax is likely to be owed. Because once you know that, then you can start to design strategies for where to take money from if they need more money than they're going to get from a pension of $500 a month.
Right.
And then it was like, well, are they eligible for Social Security? And if so, when are they planning to take that? It is, oh, well, there's retirement accounts. There's some 401k accounts and there's some IRA accounts. No Roth account. Okay. We also didn't set up how old are they?
Yeah.
Because that matters, right? All of these are relevant because it affects how much the taxes may cost you. But for all of our listeners to understand that, I think we need to kind of help you understand what kinds of taxes even exist in the first place. Because you know what I see all the time? I see people that don't understand some really basics when it comes to tax code. Like real basic blocking and tackling stuff that it seems intuitive to a planner, because we see it all the time. But it would surprise you the number of people that think that you can, like they don't know the difference between a capital gain or an income tax, right?
Right.
Because you hear something like, hey, you know what? We should make the rich pay their fair share. How is that even possible if Warren Buffett pays less tax than his secretary?
Right.
And I would say, I want everybody to listen to this for a second. How is it fair if, now remember, Warren Buffett's like a multi billionaire, right? How can Warren Buffett pay less tax than his secretary? And somebody out there's like, they don't call them secretaries anymore. I'm like, shut up. You know what I mean? Gosh, I can't keep up with whatever PC term is anymore. So I just blow it. I'm just not very PC anymore. I'm It's actually more fun. So let's answer this question. Okay. How would that happen? This is perfect. We're going to take our first break because it's going to set me up for this. When we come back, it also means during the break, I'm totally prepping Jester for this. It's going to be hilarious.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
But we're going to ask, like, why can Warren Buffett pay less tax? And that's a tricky word. Lower tax than his administrative help. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Bregman.
And
Emma Arndt.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Justin Bregman
and
Emma Arndt.
And remember, if you're just getting caught up, this is a chance to go get the podcast, right? If you haven't subscribed already, go to your favorite podcast environment and you can subscribe and you'll get these shows every week. We post them tomorrow. Or you can go to our webpage under the Knowledge Center and they're available there. Got a whole bunch of these things. And so, we're there to go back like more than a decade now. So a bunch of past programs. But today's show is about taxes. Justin, and I guess Emma, I'm going to include you in this too because you do have a microphone, right? So that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Why, we asked the question, why does Warren Buffett's secretary pay less tax than Warren Buffett? And first thing first, is it a fair question?
No.
It's a loaded question,
yeah,
isn't it?
I would say no.
Yeah. I mean, why is the question loaded?
Because I guess of how you ask the question is more in taxes per secretary's income versus Warren Buffett. The dollar amount he pays is probably lots more.
Yeah. I mean, Warren pays more in taxes than he pays his secretary.
Right.
So, like, that's the issue here is that there's a lot of taxation.
Yeah.
In terms of dollars paid.
Back when he brought that up, he did pay $23.7 million in taxes.
Yeah.
But it was only 0.1% of what he made.
Well.
And so that 0.1%, that rate is lower than the rate that his secretary was paying. But he did pay $23.7 million in taxes.
Right. And when people say, well, it's not fair that he's not paying more, I say, okay. So first of all, to anybody out there that likes to play the fair game, I'm going to say, like, well, how hot do you like your shower? Right? If you can't fair give enough. Me a temperature, so like, you like warm showers? It's like, okay, well, is 50 degrees warm? Because compared to zero, it is.
Yeah.
But it's not a very warm shower. So these subjective terms really bother me. Like, mm-hmm. They really do because that's the political trap. Right. This is where politicians manipulate people rather than bringing us together. Why do they manipulate us? It's useful. Okay.
Okay.
So on this program, I tend to squash a lot of the partisanship. I would say I fiscal conservative. Yeah, I'm not scared to look at that. Am I, you know, kind of a faith-based belief structure on how things work in the world? Yes, all of those things are part of it. Right. But we're not here to pick a political team because it turns out at different points in time, both teams are pretty stupid.
Yes.
And because I don't want to get manipulated by that game. So we better understand the game. Warren Buffett doesn't get paid much of a salary. Okay. Most people, when they go to work, they get an income.
Mm-hmm.
And the IRS says, okay, well, that's pretty easy. I get a notification from your employer as to how much you were paid. You get at the end of the year, you get a W-2,
mm-hmm.
right? And they send that W-2 to the IRS and it tells the IRS, you made this much money.
Yep.
Now, if you don't report that to us and we're gonna reconcile what your employer said versus what you said. And if those don't match, you're gonna have a problem.
Yeah.
So, and lots of these documents, have you ever heard of like a 1099?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's happening there, right? Somebody sent the IRS a notification that you were paid some type of income or capital gain. And now you also get that notice and the IRS is saying, okay, I'm gonna have to reconcile. What they say they paid you and what you're telling us they paid you, make sure it's the same.
Yep. The checks and balances.
That's that's how this works.
I just looked it up. His salary has been $100,000 for the last 35 years.
Yep.
He doesn't accept any bonuses or anything like that.
Right. So when he pays his tax on his salary, it's like he's earning $100,000. And people are like, well, that's ridiculous. He's a bazillionaire.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But he, so one is he has a very high net worth. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's think about it this way. If you bought a house for $100,000 and you paid cash for it, and then you discovered that that house was on top of a gold mine.
Okay.
And you had the mineral rights to it, and there was $100 billion of gold under your house. Okay.
You don't have $100 billion.
Well, you have a net worth now of $100 billion,
right,
and the house on top of that. But you don't have $100 billion in the bank.
No.
You have $100 billion worth of value that you control. Now you can start mining the gold, and then you can sell it to somebody, and now you turn some of that gold into cash.
Right.
And then if you spend the cash, you know, you're the numbers start to move. But that's part of what happens. Like when somebody creates, here's probably a better example. Like, all right, let's see if you guys could figure it out. They make coffee. There's a windmill that started in Grants Pass. Now it's not here anymore. Yeah. Okay. Who am I thinking of?
Dutch Brothers.
Okay. This is a fun one, because a lot of people know this is a local company. It was a local grown.
Yeah.
Yep.
They moved headquarters to Arizona.
Yep.
So they left. There's probably some tax reasons for that. We're going to try not to pound that drum too hard today, but it'll come up sometimes. You can buy stock in that company, right? So then you would be an owner in it too. But the people that started Dutch Brothers, they're billionaires now.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because they sold. Here's how this happens, by the way. You ever wonder how somebody can be a billionaire on paper and not have $1 billion? I can explain it. Think of it like you have a company that you create, and then you need to raise capital, right? I want to be able to get other money so I can expand my company. So Dutch Brothers wanted to build a bunch more Dutch Brothers all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
So they get the company valued by an investment banker. Okay, not what you think. An investment banker is not the person that gives you the loan at the bank. It's actually a different firm than a traditional bank. But investment bankers will value the company, and then they will sell a portion of it in the initial public offering or IPO.
Right.
And that's how they get the value. So what they'll say is, hey, we're going to sell. Let's make up a fictional example. We're going to do 1 million shares at $100 per share. Mm-hmm. That we're going to sell to the public, and it's going to represent 10% of the available shares in the company. So we're going to sell 10% of Dutch Brothers, or in this case, 10% of, you know, publicly traded coffee company.
XYZ.
Yep. Because I don't know that this is the real math of Dutch, right? But if we're thinking about, we're going to sell this coffee company that we created, and I'm going to sell 10%, and I'm going to keep 90. Let's say I created the company, and it's all right. I need to raise money, so 10% of the company. I have, what do they say?
A million shares
at $100 a piece. Yep. So I'm trying to raise $100 million for 10% of my company. What's my company worth? It's $1 billion.
$1 billion company.
It's $1 billion company, and I'm going to sell 10% of it to the public. Then the public's going to give me that $100 million. I'm going to use that $100 million to then go. They're going to give it. They're going to buy, right? They're going to exchange. They take shares, and then I take the cash. And then I use that cash to go and build more Dutch Brothers, or my more coffee company, right? Sorry, I keep confusing myself now. You guys follow what just happened? We created $1 billion valuation on paper. We didn't create $1 billion of liquidity. We created $1 billion of how we appraise the value of something.
Right.
Like if you built a house from scratch, and then you said, well, here's the cost of the raw materials that went into it. But the house is worth way more than that because you built this really awesome place in a really great location. Then you created value by producing something that wasn't there before. That's how development works. And that's how it works in business. Well, that's what Warren Buffett does. And what Warren Buffett gets is the appreciation in the companies that he owns.
Right.
So his net worth, the value of his assets, has increased. But that's not necessarily taxable.
Right.
You know what is taxable? Those companies distribute profits to shareholders in the form of dividends. Ah, that's an income stream.
Mm-hmm.
And Warren Buffett can pay taxes on that income.
Correct.
Okay. Oh, we sell a company for a profit. That becomes a taxable event too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a different kind of tax.
Okay.
What kind of tax are we talking about now? Right? If I sell an asset, that's not income.
Right.
It's a profit tax. We call that a capital gain. But capital gains have a weird flavor to them, right? Because you ever wonder why there's two different, like, there's short-term and long-term capital gains. Do you ever ask, like, why do you think there's short-term and long-term capital gains?
My first answer to this would be is if it's longer than a year, it's harder to manipulate.
So,
which that might not be the answer.
Well, I don't know the actual answer per se, but I'm pretty confident this is the answer, which usually ends up being true.
Yeah.
Justin doesn't
have this conversation.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, because the system works a certain way. This is not a comment like, oh, Dave knows. It's because the system kind of has this wiring. And so if you understand the wiring and the way it was built, and it's like, well, you know, usually it behaves this way. And it's like, oh, that was the same example. That's how it behaves. So it often works out that way.
Okay.
It's not. I'm not making a comment like, I'm right because I'm right. I'm making a comment of like, I think the framework represents
it. Yeah, Justin and I did have a conversation this morning about how you're right about a lot of things.
<it's>
so
annoying.
That's why we're laughing over like, no, not annoying. It was an amazement, honestly.
Fact-checking you, and then I just gave up. I'm like, I'm just going to call it 95% accurate and go from there.
Well, anyway, so if you are in the business, let's break down why, because all I'm trying to help our listeners understand is, like, your income is pretty easy to understand. Hey, I earned income because I got paid for doing work from somebody. We're not talking about being self-employed. We're working for somebody else. They paid me. That's income.
Mm-hmm.
I owned something that did a profit share with me. The IRS says, same thing. It's income, right? We call it a dividend, but it's going to be taxed the same way.
Right.
Because it's just income to you. But what if your job is flipping houses and you buy and sell a house every 90 days? Okay.
Right.
Well, you're not really getting paid an income, but you're flipping a house every 90 days. That's your job. And so they basically say, well, if you're flipping houses in less than a year for a job, then you should pay income tax on it. That's your job.
Okay.
Right? So it's the frame up is like, well, less than a year. And the other is there is an incentive to encourage people to invest long term because long term investment is more stable for the system. So it kind of works both ways. Short term, it really is acting like your job. This is also why day traders pay short term capital gains tax.
Right.
That's their job.
That's their job.
So they're going to just turn that capital gain into an income. Why do I say job? Because short term capital gains, from the IRS perspective, are taxed like income.
Right.
They just have the same income tax rate. But if you hold it for a year and a day, so 366 days, then it becomes a long-term capital gain. That's actually a different tax rate.
Right.
And it's lower than income taxes.
Usually more favorable.
Yeah. Why would they do that? Because they're trying to incentivize people to invest longer term. And also the cynical view of this is because politicians own a lot of stock, and so they're giving themselves a deal.
Right.
And honestly, that's probably part of it. What could you do? Anyway, there's the basic primer of income taxes versus capital gains taxes and the frame up of why there's this disparity and how that's the most common thing I see is people misunderstand the difference between gains and income and how that gets taxed. Okay? That's probably the biggest. But now that we have that knowledge, what does it mean in terms of planning? Like, how can you use this knowledge to become more efficient, better stewards of the money? And the idea being, how can we use this knowledge to give what we need to Uncle Sam, but not more. Okay? We're going to unpack more of that, but as it turns out, we got to take a break. So we're going to do that now. Stick around when we come back. Let's talk about how we can keep more money in our pocket and less money in the pocket of the IRS. I am Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Brugman.
And Emma Arndt.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we got a studio full today. Joining me is
Justin Brugman
and
Emma Arndt.
Right. We're seeing, Emma, it's fun. You're more, Emma's run like a lot of the tech behind the scenes for our podcasting, which has gotten a lot better. Well, and for our like live stream. And so now we're starting a YouTube channel and we're trying to develop this content. Why do I share this? Because if there are things that you would like to learn, maybe you don't get it on the radio show, but we do create content that's going online so that you can get this information. If you are looking for it, and you can ask us questions. So send us an email to info@littlejohnfs.com. Why is it littlejohnfs? Because somebody already had Little John. And I tried to get it from them, and they're like, nope, I like it. Like, all right, well, then it's got to be Little John FS and financial services. We'll work with it. Meanwhile, today we're talking taxes, and we've already covered the basics of what kind of taxes they are. And then, Emma, will you share with our audience? You asked kind of a fun question during the break, and I'd just love to share it with our audience.
Oh, yeah. So my question was, if you're living in a house for less than a year, but it's your primary residence, like you intended to keep it as a long-term thing, like how do the taxes work on that? Does it still count as a short-term capital gain or a long-term?
Yeah. So I think I understand the question, right? So, but I'm going to parrot it back to you just to make sure. The question is, hey, I live in this house, but I'm going to end up, I intended to stay in the house, but for whatever reason, you know, I'm getting transferred by work or something like that, so I have to sell it. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get to live in it for that long, so it's a residence, but am I going to pay capital gains on it? And the short answer is yes, however, I'm going to add a little bit of color to this because the question has, there's probably some other things that maybe listeners have heard about before, and I'm going to try to clear this up. Let me first disclose this. This isn't tax advice. And this just changes, right? So this is as our understanding right now, but take this information as is. Always verify this stuff. I'm just some dude on the radio, right? So don't take advice off the radio, but we're going to do the best we can here nevertheless. So there's a tax exemption available for homeowners. Mm-hmm. And what it says is if you live in a home for 2 out of 5 years as your primary residence, and this is important, and I'll explain why in a second, but for 2 out of the last 5 years, a home was your primary residence, then you can get a $250,000 exemption from federal capital gains taxes. Now, depending on which state you're in, whether or not there's a state exemption depends. In the state of Oregon, you get this exemption as well, is my understanding. And if you are married, your spouse gets that same exemption, so it doubles. So you could have a $500,000 exemption. This is significant because let's say you bought a house for $300,000 and it's worth $600,000. Well, if it's just you, you could owe taxes because it's more than $250,000 of profit. But if you're married, you could end up selling the home and having no tax burden at all from a capital gains perspective. Now, have that house appreciated to $1 million, then you would have exceeded your $500,000 joint exemption. And there'd still be some capital gains on it. And what I would say is that's a great problem to have. Your house has really gone up in value, so now you have to deal with the taxes. But there's still a $500,000 exemption.
And it resets. After 2 years. So you can do it again.
Yeah, as soon as it's done, then if you move, then you get a new 2-year window for the new place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's where it's really interesting, and here's where it's strategic as well. So the primary residence thing, first, your question, Emma, was, well, what if I hadn't lived there for a year? My understanding is that then the exemption is prorated by the amount of time you've lived there. Incidentally, the exemption goes, like, is extended to any time frame. Like, it's waived. There's no 2 out of 5 year requirement. This is so weird. But for parents with multiple gestation births, meaning you had twins or more, if you have twins, you don't have to live in a home for 5 years and or for two of the 5 years. It's a weird exemption.
That is so weird.
Why do I know about it? Friends of mine had twins and they explained it to me. Now my brother has some twins and he verified it too. And it's like, yep, we can move if we want to. And anytime, and we get the exemption. And it's just a weird carve out. There was probably a politician who had a kid that had twins and they were running into this and they're like, we got to fix that. So now if you have twins, you can move because our house doesn't work anymore. We had to move because we had twins. So go figure, right? There's weird rules that make it in. That's one of them. But here's another thing people don't think about, and this is sort of a planning deal. And some realtors understand this, not all, but some. Let's say that you own a rental property, and you've owned it for 20 years. And you've depreciated it to the point that you have basically zero basis. Remember, basis is not a term we've thrown out a lot. But it means, it's think about it like your purchase price. Right. If you depreciate a house, you have to depreciate your purchase price. So it looks like you got the house for free, which means, great, I have a zero price on my house. Now it's worth $400,000. If I sell it, I pay taxes on $400,000 profit because my basis was zero. If I bought the house for $300,000, sold it for $400,000, and you think, hey, no problem, right? I only made $100,000. Nope, because if you depreciate it all away, it's like you bought the house for zero.
Right.
Anyway, you've owned it for a long time. You're not interested in paying taxes. You're thinking about maybe doing something else with your primary residence. You move into the rental for 2 years. You go ahead and sell it at that point. The rental has been your primary residence for 2 years, and you get the exemption to apply to the rental. You can then move back into your other residence again. And once you've had two of the 5 years in there, you can use it again and you can do that. So you can sort of deconvert a rental. Here's what happens a lot of the time and where it's interesting. Okay. Somebody buys a starter house and then they move out of the starter house and move into a new house and they keep the starter house and turn it into a rental. After 3 years has passed, you lose the ability to sell without the capital gains exemption.
Because two of the last 5 years.
So that's it. If you have about a 3 year window. If you're going to consider converting your home, your primary residence into a rental, and you want to undo the decision. Otherwise, after that, it becomes a rental and the tax treatment is as such. So there you go.
You know, 2 year plan for $1 million.
Well, it can potentially be a big example. Yeah, if you have a lot of, if you have a highly appreciated properties, you got to be willing to move back into it too. A lot of people are like, I want to move into my rental. Like, well, okay. So that's your call. But nevertheless, it's an option. So now we have unpacked one of the weird exemptions, and it's the primary residence exemption. Big deal, right? It's a big deal. It means that. It's one of the things that's unspoken, by the way, in planning. We tend to look at it and say, well, what's the cost of rent versus buying? But we don't necessarily look at the value of the appreciation being tax-free.
Right.
If you apply this exemption amount. So, you know, when you factor that into the math, the house becomes a more favorable asset. Like, as a primary resident, if you're willing to sell it, the fact that you're willing to sell it means you could be taking equity out tax-free. So there you have it. Now, there are some other tax questions and little tax hacks that we probably should talk about. One of my favorites is where the retirement plan world lives, and specifically this concept of Roth that did get a little weird this year for people over 50. Roth contributions and retirement plan excess contributions got a little weird. We need to talk about that, but we also got to take our last break. So we're going to do that, and then we're going to come back, and then I'm going to explain to you why I think Roth IRAs and potentially Roth 401ks or 403bs are pretty awesome, but we gotta do this first. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Justin Bergman.
Emma Arndt.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we got the home stretch here. And one of the last things I wanted to talk about today, because we really covered a lot of ground on the basics of taxes and why this is really foundationally critical stuff to understand. So let me give a quick recap here. Income taxes are not the same as taxes on assets that appreciate in value. Like assets, we pay capital gains on. If we only own them for the short term, meaning less than a year, we're going to treat the profits just like we would income. So they're going to be taxed like income. And income is progressive in nature, meaning the more that you make, the higher the tax rate goes.
Right.
One of the most common misconceptions is that taxes are retroactive, meaning, oh, I was in the 10% bracket, but I made too much money, and now I'm in a 15% bracket, and all of my income is now taxed at 15%.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's not true.
The last dollar is the most expensive dollar.
Yeah, it's only the income earned above the 10% bracket that is now in the higher bracket. Okay, so this is important, by the way, because the state of Washington just passed, and we'll see if it sticks, but they did just pass an income tax for those earning more than $1 million. Now, does that mean that and it's 9.9%. Well, that means that if you make $1,001,000, your tax is basically 10 cents because you only made $1 over a million. But if you make $2 million, then it's a 10% tax on the $1 million above the first million. Right, so it's not taxing all $2 million at 10%. It's taxing only the stuff above that threshold. And the skeptic would say, for now, to which I would say, hashtag true story. Because these legislators are notorious for moving these numbers around when they want to fill budget gaps. And so you have this tendency to start either not adjusting for inflation or moving stuff around until you capture enough people to pay for the thing that you're trying to pay for.
Right.
So there we have it.
And in Washington, there is no income tax. So
there is not. I suspect this is a terrible idea, just as a side note. I mean, I'll just flat out say it. The reason I think it's a terrible idea is a bunch of people are just like, what? They can afford it. They're making over $1 million. Yeah, they can also afford to leave.
Yeah, that's
the
problem.
And usually the people that have that income are the ones that own the businesses.
Right.
Because the income is what flows through. So if you have a business where you employ 50, 60, 100 people and you make a couple $1 million at the end of the year, well, you've had payroll for 100 people.
Right.
So they've all paid into the system. You're still paying into the system, but what you're now saying is, oh, success penalty. And then what do? They say, oh, well, why don't I move my business somewhere where they won't penalize me for that? Mm-hmm. And the problem is, oh, it only hits a few people. Yes, but it hits the few people that are the ones that are creating the most jobs typically, and the few people that are, and keep in mind, like even like a Hollywood actor or something, the movie doesn't happen without the actors. And then you look at how many people are employed in that movie. Thousands of people sometimes. It all happens because of these critical folks at the top that make a bunch of money, and you're like, we got to make them pay their fair share. I'm like, careful, because you may just incentivize them to leave. Ask California how many businesses have moved to Texas. And what that's doing to their budgets, because it really has real effects. So anyway, but that's not the Roth conversation. We got to get to that in the last few minutes. So help our listeners out. Why is a Roth unique, and what's different about a Roth that they need to understand?
Well, the tax-free growth is probably the biggest, the most awesomeness about the Roth is it grows, and then when you take the distributions, it is not taxable at all.
Yeah, and you the trick though is you pay for it with money that you've already paid taxes on.
Right, pay for it now.
Yeah, this is kind of a fun little concept. If you pay attention to one thing on this show that will help you understand taxes better for the rest of your life, the IRS makes you pay taxes on income once. typically, right? It's they get you on the way in or they get you on the way out. Roth IRA, they got you on the way in. Before the money went into the Roth, you paid taxes on it. And so then the money grows tax deferred. And when you come out, they say, great, tax free on the way out. As long as you hit all the qualifying marks, right? As long as you make sure that it stays a Roth. Because if you take it out early or you do other things, you can break the rules and then you pay the tax. But they get you on the way in or they get you on the way out. So like a traditional 401k plan, what do? You put the money in before you pay the tax.
Right.
Which means when do you pay the tax? When you take it out later. That's it. And now, what about, there are certain weird environments. They're not retirement plans. Hey, I can put it into an insurance program like an annuity. Oh, well, I put after-tax money in. Then it grows tax deferred, but when I take it out, the money I already paid taxes on, I get back. Right. But the money that I haven't paid taxes on yet, I have to pay tax on. So it's a split, right? Because it wasn't a retirement plan, but it was a tax deferral mechanism.
Right.
Now, what about just an account that you don't get any tax deferral at all? How does that work?
You taxed on the way.
Yeah. You just taxed as they're realized.
Yeah.
Did you sell the thing? This is one of the most dangerous things out there, by the way. The concept of a wealth tax, I think, is a terrible, terrible idea. This idea that, well, billionaires don't pay their fair share. Like, Warren Buffett should pay more. But he didn't sell anything. He bought a company and he still owns it. And they're like, well, they should make him pay taxes. With what money?
Yeah.
You're going to say, well, he has to sell it then in order to create money to pay the tax. And so now what you're doing is saying people are not allowed to own things.
Yeah.
That's effectively what you're doing. Very dangerous idea. You do not want to go down the path of having no private ownership or private control anymore. And I know some of you are out there already arguing. You're like, well, we don't really anyway. If you don't pay your property taxes, they'll take your house. It's like, well, that is true, but you still have a lot of discretionary authority over what happens on the property that's declared yours, and other people don't.
Right.
And so do you want to erode that even further? Because that would be what happens if you institute a wealth tax, is it's just going to keep drifting until, oh, well, then who gets to own the companies if not the creator? Who's going to create a company if they can't own it? Yeah. Oh, what incentive to perform or to do anything? Like, there's, you take all the risk but get none of the reward. Who's going to sign up for that? Like, I wouldn't.
Yeah, no one.
Yeah, I'm going to take on all the liability of something going wrong, and I'm not going to get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Only an idiot would do that. I like saying that on the show, by the way. I love like announcing, like only an idiot would do something like that. It's like, can I ruffle someone's feathers? So I mentioned one other caveat. I don't know if you've heard about this one or not, but Roth IRAs, there's a limit to how much money you can make before you phase out of being able to have one. There are some ways around it. We're not going to discuss the concept of a backdoor Roth IRA on the show today. But what's interesting is that phase out is now being applied to catch up contributions in 401k plans. And so I believe it's as of 2026. Please check this, by the way, rather than just taking my word for it. But my understanding is if you are age 50 or older, in the calendar year that you turn age 50 or older, you're then eligible for catch-up contributions in retirement plans.
Right.
And in employer-sponsored plans, those contributions must now be in Roth accounts, meaning the catch-up contributions cannot be in pre-tax dollars. This is not that cool, by the way, because one, folks that are in higher... If you're trying to save more in retirement and they're forcing you into a Roth, there's a little secret about Roths that a lot of people miss. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, you're paying the taxes on it.
Well, you're paying the tax on that part. So that's true. But also the five-year clock.
Correct.
Explain what this means.
When you either start a Roth IRA or do a conversion, well, in even this case, when you transfer from a Roth 401k into a Roth IRA, it triggers a five-year clock that the account has to be funded and active for the distribution to be considered tax-free.
Yeah, think of this. You have a Roth contribution into your 401k plan,
mm-hmm.
and then you retire at 65 and you roll your 401k Roth into a Roth IRA, it doesn't behave like a Roth now until you're 70. It starts a new five-year clock on all the money that you rolled over. What I'm unclear of, and I'll admit to this on air, is whether or not each successive contribution into an employer-sponsored Roth gets a new five-year clock, or if it's just at the inception of the account. In a personal account, the Roth starts the day you fund it. But yeah, conversions, which is what a backdoor Roth is, every conversion gets a fresh five-year clock.
Correct.
So it gets tax messy if you do this a lot. There's documentation required. And so that's, if you ever wonder why financial planners are still around and AI hasn't taken the job over yet, because you didn't know to ask that question. Yeah. So AI didn't know how to answer it. And that's a tax time bomb that could blow up in your face if you didn't know about it. So
I believe, if I remember right, the Roth IRA can, the Roth 401k can go into a Roth IRA if you have an existing one, and it doesn't trigger that clock. The conversions do.
I know conversions do.
And I think that the other one is.
Yeah, but if it's a brand new Roth IRA, then those contributions. And so this, by the way, is the stuff we have to research, because those rules move. So we have to refresh those all the time too. But
yeah, I'm seeing on the IRS.gov website, it says that the clock generally starts with the very first contribution to that specific plan rather than resetting for each individual contribution.
Nice. Well, look, we're out of time, so I'm going to do this real quickly, and then we're going to dash. If you've got questions, give us a call, 541-375-0898. Until next time, we got to run.